morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jody Corrales on behalf of Appellant Fernando Orengo. Your Honors, Mr. Orengo seeks a reversal of the District Court's ruling refusing to recognize the doctrine of latches in invalidating the government's complaint for denaturalization. This is a case of the government strictly enforcing the immigration statutes. This is a case of the government manipulating the immigration statutes. In this case, Mr. Orengo first arrived to the United States in 1972 on a student visa. Mr. Orengo obtained his permanent resident status in 1980. And in 1982, it was discovered that Mr. Orengo obtained his permanent resident status through a sham marriage. In fact, on September 15, 1982, Mr. Orengo signed an affidavit to that effect, demonstrating that he did, in fact, obtain his permanent resident status illegally or improperly. However, Mr. Orengo's position is that although the government was aware of the sham marriage, the government was complicit in allowing him and his sister, Ms. Amparo Balbuena, to naturalize despite the illegal obtainment of the permanent resident status. And that is when
does the clock start to run, in your view? Known as when does the denaturalization clock start to run as opposed to some of the earlier events?
In this case, September 15, 1982, when Mr. Orengo signed the affidavit, that was when the government had affirmative notice of Mr. Orengo's illegal obtainment of his permanent resident status. And therefore, the government waited until 2009, which is 27 years later, to initiate denaturalization proceedings.
When was he naturalized?
He was naturalized in 1989.
Okay, well, the 1982 date can't work, right?
Well, that was when the government was aware of his illegal obtainment.
So, but that means that you think that the government shouldn't have granted him citizenship in the first place in 1989. So, if anything, the government's been diligent for 20 years, maybe 27 years. This argument seems to me to sound as much in latches as it does in a syllable.
That may be correct, Justice Baby. It might be an estoppel issue.
Estoppel against the government is almost never granted. When the Supreme Court has reserved the possibility that it might be granted, it might be available in the most egregious of cases.
I believe this court has ruled in Salgado Diaz versus Gonzalez that equitable estoppel can be applied to prevent the government from relying on consequences of its own affirmative conduct. So I believe
the government's affirmative misconduct.
The affirmative misconduct is the government knowing and voluntarily aware and complicit with Mr. Orengo's illegal.
And this is just the government just generally that we're not talking about any particular person. I mean, it looks like the mistake that was made here was that there were two files created by Mr. Orengo and the government failed to marry them up until after he was convicted of the cocaine dealing.
But the government had explicit knowledge and
the government.
It's really, you're sort of making a
constructive
knowledge argument. And then the question is, well, what's the support for that? Because we have a situation of there's this incriminating affidavit in the New York file, correct?
Correct.
So you're saying that government, B over here, should have had constructive knowledge of government A over here, that there was this file, this affidavit in another file. And I'm not aware of case law that would make that kind of a leap. And so I'm open to hearing so I can look it up.
And just to be clear, I apologize, but I did not find any case law that's applicable in this context. But I can tell you that it stretches credulity to believe that Mr. Orengo would apply to obtain his naturalization in 1989, knowing that he would, in fact, jeopardize his status to remain in the United States if it weren't for his belief that he was allowed to go ahead and naturalize.
And I don't think that argument goes too far, because sadly, many individuals do things that jeopardizes their immigration status when they probably shouldn't, whether it's signing up for a certain program that may or may not continue, or whether it's applying for asylum when, in fact, they have some kind of disqualifying felony. So the fact that somebody decides to see if they can go one step further, I'm not sure is a legal basis for granting the denaturalization,
In addition to that, in 2002, Mr. Ringo applied for a position with the Department of Homeland Security, which he knew would be, he would have to comply with strict immigration sections.
Well, suppose that I thought that there was some misconduct on the government by failing to marry up these two files. You know, one office didn't know what the other office had decided. And what's the harm to Mr. Ringo? He was given citizenship in the United States, which he probably was not entitled to. He was given a job with Border Patrol, which he never should have been given. And then he misbehaved and has pay violations. So where's the bad things that happened to Mr. Ringo as a result of government misconduct?
The prejudice that Mr. Ringo suffered was an effective evidentiary prejudice in that during the trial, there were three INS agents who testified based on the recollection of events that had transpired in the early 1980s. And while some did remember the actual events.
There's something else you missed my question. It can't be an evidentiary problem based on the last argument. It was the old memories thing. That's not Mr. Ringo's problem. If you're going to argue that there's affirmative misconduct by the government, I want to know how was Mr. Ringo harmed here? He was never entitled to citizenship in 1989. That was the government's mistake. So he's never entitled to it. Now the government wants to take it away, and you want to argue they can't because of government misconduct. Well, where's the harm to Mr. Ringo? He got something he wasn't entitled to twice. That was citizenship to a job with the Border Patrol.
The harm is that he's built a life here since the 1970s, and now
Mr. Suckered him into thinking that he was going to be comfortable here for the rest of his life. That's the harm. It's only now he gets to stay here for the rest of his life as the government's engaged in misconduct. By wrongfully approving his citizenship.
Or not just so wrongfully approving, but being complicit in allowing him to go forward.
He can still be in the situation he was before had he not committed the crime, right?
And that's correct.
I mean, he was in this protected bubble of ignorance. And he's the one that broke the bubble.
That's correct, but there are other immigration statutes that should be in play in that because he was a United States citizen, the government is trying to make an in-round into trying to get him removed from the United States by using that instance of criminal conduct in which the government would not be able to do so had it not been for Mr. Ringo's illegal procurement of the permanent resident status. So here they are trying to backtrack, saying, well, wait a minute, because I can't get you out of the country, if you had a valid United States citizenship, I can't do that based on one criminal offense. He served his prison time for that offense, but now they're trying to make an in-run around that, those statutes by saying you shouldn't have been here in the first place, but they knew he was here illegally in the first place and failed to act. And in fact, when he naturally
did it, does it boil down to the fact that because there was something in the New York file that the entire U.S. government immigration apparatus should have known of that?
That's Mr. Ringo's position, yes, that the government should have been aware of his success.
Should have for just a minute. We have to be a little realistic here. The immigration problem is horrendous. There's 11 million people walking around, and they're trying to deal with it. And it is something like the corner drugstore where we expect everybody to keep records. And I suppose that they're making some pretty strong requirements here upon the government that they are actually going to know what all these 11 million people are, and they will periodically know it, part of it, not in the other, because they aren't fully computerized, or they have devised a way to get the government fully computerized, and maybe never will. So the Sixth Circuit just says, well, why are we worried about this? As Judge Bybee says, the total information is clear. The man did not deserve to be here, nor does he deserve to be here now. And so you say no latches. Sixth Circuit says latches doesn't apply to the government for very practical reasons. Why shouldn't we follow the Sixth Circuit and be realistic about it?
Just as well as I realize that it's unrealistic to assume that the government should know of all of its files and the immigration status of all of the millions of people walking around this country. I understand that's impracticable and unrealistic, but in this case, the government knew of Mr. Ringo's status, and in fact,
some part of the government knew, and other part of the government that you can't just say the government knew. I mean, the government is, you know, is people. And you see the government, you're saying it like everybody knows, but everybody doesn't know. That's why the Sixth Circuit gave that direction. Now, is there some compelling reason that we shouldn't follow the Sixth Circuit case? We should determine otherwise and create a split in the circuits.
How can we reconcile the government's knowledge of Mr. Rangel's sister, Ms. Valbuena? It is clear that the government is aware that Ms. Valbuena obtained her permanent residence status through the same sham marriage ring that Mr. Rangel obtained his permanent residence status from. The government is aware of that, and we know that. We do know also that the government has failed to proceed against Ms. Valbuena and bring a denationalization action. So it's not
that
it's a different
argument. Can't get the government for latches. And it all comes out now, and they say, your defense is latches, and they say, no, you shouldn't do that. Now we know what the real facts are, and the person should not get away with it because the government is big. Okay, why not? Why should we create an inner circuit split on that issue?
I think the very simple answer to that is the Costello case.
Yes, sir.
Simple answer is Costello. So the United States Supreme Court in Costello did not foreclose upon the possibility that a denaturalization defendant can rely on the doctrine of latches. And in fact, in that case, it was a close call in that the government found that, well, there might have been lack of diligence on behalf of the government's part. The defendant there, Mr. Costello, failed to show prejudice. In that case, the defendant was naturalized and said he was a real estate agent. He was really a bootlegger. And at the time that he naturalized, the government wasn't aware of his status until 1938 when there were criminal proceedings. So in that case, those are different facts. And I believe in this case, our facts are a lot stronger to compel that latches be recognized in this circuit. And in line with the Second Circuit, who also has not foreclosed upon the opportunity of acknowledging that latches is a valid defense against the government. There is a Sixth Circuit case, Sixth Circuit, in Cummings, I believe, that says, no, the government is immune. You cannot proceed. You cannot use latches as a defense. But this court has, in fact, in regard to Dang, in the Dang case, has actually left the possibility open to recognizing latches as a defense. In that case, the facts were a lot weaker than this case. And there should be no immunity by the government. If the government knows and makes affirmative efforts and action to proceed along a certain course of conduct and then tries to backtrack, the government should be stopped from doing so. And Justice, I would like to reserve the remaining 2 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Timothy Dawson on behalf of the United States. In this appeal, the appellate, Mr. Arango, is not contesting the underlying merits of the order denaturalizing him. He appears not to challenge the district court's conclusions that he entered into an illegal and a sham marriage, that he was therefore ineligible both for adjustment of status and for citizenship, and that during the naturalization process, he deliberately concealed that sham marriage. All of his arguments today on appeal are good to equitable and procedural issues. I think an important starting point is the Supreme Court's statement in Fedorenko that courts lack equitable jurisdiction to refrain from entering the judgment of denaturalization against individuals whose citizenship was illegally procured or procured by willful misrepresentation or material facts. That doctrine, that lack of equitable jurisdiction to apply a defense against the government, was recognized by this court just last year in March 2016 in the Zhao case and in the Fareed case in 2011. So I'd like to start with that doctrine. And then turning to latches, the opponent's first argument is the government's position that latches never applies in a civil denaturalization action. While this court recognized in Dane that that's an open question in this circuit, as Judge Bybee has acknowledged in the Sixth Circuit, the Mendez's case, the Sixth Circuit has come to the conclusion that Costello, the Supreme Court case on point, did not really leave this door open. And although Costello assumed for purposes of that case that it might apply, it did
did so because, under the facts of that case, the doctrine didn't apply. So the court did not need to reach the question of whether it could ever apply in a civil denaturalization case. While we would agree that that is the case here as well, that this court could find on these facts that the doctrine does not apply, nonetheless, we would take the position that, in general, for several reasons, latches never applies against the government in a denaturalization action, a civil denaturalization action. First, that's because in a denaturalization action, the government is acting in its sovereign capacity. Latches is not a defense when the government is acting as a sovereign. Indeed, there's no more quintessential action than naturalization or denaturalization. There's no individual rights, no individual person can bring an action either to naturalize or to denaturalize any individual. Therefore, in this case, when the government is acting in its sovereign capacity, latches should not apply. Similarly, because it's an equitable defense, as this court has recognized, we would fall within the Fedorenko guidance, as well as the guidance from this court in Zhao and Farid, that no district court should apply a defense inequity in a denaturalization case. And third, this Congress, in enacting the statute, made no indication of a time limit that it intended to apply. It knows how to do so. It did so in the criminal context, in the related action, if there was an action to revoke naturalization because of fraud. In the criminal context, there's a 10-year statute. Here, there is no guidance for Congress. Should the court reach the question of whether latches actually applies in these facts, we would point to the doctrine of unclean hands, which would also bar the appellant from bringing his latches argument. In general formulas, this court recognized that a party with unclean hands may not assert latches. And here, Mr. Arango has unclean hands. This court found that he deliberately misled the interviewer during his naturalization interview on the nature of his marriage to a U.S. citizen. Moreover, he fails to satisfy both elements of the statutory of the test, the lack of diligence by the government, and the prejudice. In Costello, the court did not reach the question of diligence because it found there was no prejudice to the defendant. We think the court can do that here as well. The evidentiary prejudice he points to is with regard to witnesses. He cites, for example, the lack of being able to find Ms. Dorado. The government would point out that appellant here has not known where Ms. Dorado was since at least 1984, 5 years before he naturalized. He forced her by publication and default judgment because he could not find her. And there's testimony in the record suggesting that he did not know where she was since he entered the United States, going back further than that. That's correct. So he never met her, and neither one attended the wedding ceremony. Instead, his sister was Valbuena, and Mr. Diaz, the leader of the marriage reverend, stood in at the wedding ceremony. In addition, Ms. Valbuena, who has probably the best information in this situation under these facts, she testified for the government at the trial, and that he knew that this was a sham marriage, that he never met Ms. Dorado, and the district court found that her memory was excellent. Mr. Arango has not challenged that factual finding. So the government witnesses also had excellent memory, according to the district court, in its factual findings. And the court, the government suggests that to the extent they don't remember a specific instance of Mr. Arango, it's in large part because he was such a minor player in the Diaz investigation, an investigation that involved more than 370 fraudulent marriages, and in which he came in after they had already concluded the criminal portion of the investigation. Mr. Diaz had already not only pled guilty, but he had actually been sentenced for several months before Mr. Arango came in and gave his sworn statement. On the documentary evidence, we would also suggest that Mr. Arango, his argument that he somehow had to submit that the ancient document exception applied, we would point to the fact that he could have attacked if he thought there was any suspicion as to the authenticity of the documents under the federal rules of evidence, as well as the fact that Mr. Arango and Ms. Valbuena themselves corroborated most of the documentary evidence. And finally, to the extent he argues that he couldn't have put forward a defense, we point to the fact that he represented himself quite ably, pro se, for the first 2 to 3 years of this litigation, including ultimately successfully getting an appeal overturning the summary judgment grant by the district court, and that he participated fully in a trial and was deposed, and that there was no indication of what he would have done differently. To the extent he argues expectation-based prejudice, we would point the government, would point to the fact that all of his arguments go to whether he's even in the United States, not whether or not he has United States citizenship. Moreover, they all stem from the fact that he committed fraud originally and gained a benefit that he should never have had and should be revoked. Those were his questions on that. I'd like to turn to the Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial question. Mr. Arango argues that he's entitled to a jury trial specifically under the Sixth Amendment and not the Seventh Amendment. Two threshold questions I think that the court should consider. First, Mr. Arango's argument has been until his reply brief that the issue was whether or not materiality with regard to the second basis under 8 U.S.C. 1451, that someone could have procured their citizenship by willful misrepresentation or concealment of a material fact. And that because of the nature of materiality, that he was entitled to a Sixth Amendment jury trial. First, that was only one of the possible, one of the three grounds on which the district court denaturalized the defendant, and therefore doesn't address all of the grounds that the court here could affirm on. Second, his jury demand was untimely, more than 3 years after his original answer, well outside the 14-day time period, and that was one of the grounds on which the district court denied or struck his jury demand. And he does not appear to be challenging the timeliness ruling on appeal today. Even if the court reaches the question of the Sixth Amendment, it's clear that the Sixth Amendment does not apply in this case. Mr. Arango cites the Gowdy case from this circuit, but conveniently overlooks the fact that Gowdy eventually was appealed to the United States Supreme Court, which affirmed the Ninth Circuit's ruling. And in that decision, the United States Supreme Court specifically distinguished Cungies, a civil denaturalization case, the case that the court had previously decided. It said, Cungies assuredly did not involve an adjudication to which the Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial attaches. That was a unanimous decision by the Supreme Court in 1995, and we would submit that that binds on this ruling, or excuse me, on this issue. Indeed, the Sixth Amendment only applies to criminal prosecutions, and this is decidedly a civil matter that was brought. In his reply brief, Mr. Arango argues that because the civil sanction is so punitive, that therefore he's entitled to a Sixth Amendment jury trial. We would argue that this is waived as it was not raised to the district court nor in his opening brief. But even if the court reaches that question, it's clear from case law that this is a remedial remedy, and this is not a punitive remedy. Indeed, the action is simply to provoke an ill-gotten benefit, an undoing of that which should not have been done in the first place. Now, the Supreme Court has made clear in Trop that denaturalization is not imposed to penalize the alien for having falsified his application for citizenship, and in Schneiderman, the denaturalization suit is not a criminal proceeding. Additionally, the Seventh and Sixth Circuits have addressed this and have found the same way that the Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial does not attach. Moreover, the Gowdy case, even the Ninth Circuit's decision, notes that it does not, it specifically distinguishes civil cases and other criminal cases, and notes that it was unique in that context because of the nature of materiality as an element under Section 1001 of the Title 18. And the Supreme Court did the same in its holding. Finally, on the Sixth Amendment issue, Cungies, the Supreme Court case that I previously mentioned, which the Gowdy Supreme Court decision distinguishes, specifically held that materiality in a civil denaturalization case is an issue of law that the court could decide for itself. It did decide the case there on that issue. It did not need to remand to the Court of Appeals or to the District Court for any further proceedings on that issue. Now, with regard to whether the District Court properly excluded testimony, the standard here is abuse of discretion, and the government submits that Mr. Arango has failed to meet that standard. The evidence that was excluded had to do with the harm that Mr. Arango would suffer, allegedly suffer, if the denaturalization was entered against him. But as I've previously pointed out, all the harms he cites are actually related to removal and not to denaturalization. Indeed, the effect of denaturalization is not automatic removal of Mr. Arango. That is a decision for a different agency. The Department of Homeland Security decides whether to bring removal proceedings against him. And that is a decision that the immigration judge will be able to rule on if and when that issue is presented. Denaturalization, the effect is simply to put the denaturalized individual back to the position they were in before the still gotten the benefit was granted. So Mr. Arango was referred back to being a lawful permanent resident, and it would be on the Department of Homeland Security whether to take additional steps. So the immediate impact on Mr. Arango is not his removal to Colombia, but rather he simply loses the citizenship he should not have had in the first place. Indeed, the effect of the defendant's argument is that he should be able to continue benefiting long after his fraud, and the mere fact that he benefited for some time means he should continue doing so. But this would encourage rather than discourage fraud in the naturalization process, that if someone can simply evade detection for long enough, they can therefore continue to maintain and benefit from the ill-gotten status, the ill-gotten citizenship. And it would encourage people who have already committed fraud to continue hiding that fraud in hope that they can continue evading detection for long enough to trigger whatever time period Mr. Arango believes is sufficient. Finally, Your Honor, I just like to point out that in his brief, Mr. Arango argues that there was a cooperation agreement and that there is some evidence to suggest that that existed. That is directly contradicted by the district court's factual findings in this case, which he has not contested, and in any event, which are, it is not clearly erroneous based on the witness's testimony, including Ms. Valbuena's testimony, that she did not have such an agreement, and she was very clearly a much more important witness for the government in the Diaz criminal case. Unless the court has any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I wanted to address briefly the unclean hands argument provided by the government's attorney. The government argues that Mr. Arango has unclean hands because he misled the interviewer during his naturalization process. Again, it's Mr. Arango's position that there could be there's no way he can mislead the interviewer in that the government had or the interviewer should have had that information.
That's why you ask the question. Sometimes we ask the questions more than once, and just because you answered it one way the first time doesn't mean that you get to answer it differently the second time when we ask the question.
I'm sorry, Justice, maybe. But I just wanted to follow up on the unclean hands argument made by the government.
But his hands are unclean here. He denied, and I don't think you can speak that.
Right, and I think the focus here has been on the sham marriage, and there's been, Mr. Arango concedes that he did obtain his permanent residence status through a sham marriage. He never met his purported wife, and that's been conceded. The real argument here rests with that naturalization interview and whether or not he validly believed that Ms. Fripp, the interviewer, had the information contained in his file, that the signed affidavit, basically. And it's Mr. Arango's position that the interviewer did have the affidavit or should have had the affidavit. And also, in addition to...
Is there any evidence that he did have the affidavit?
That Ms. Fripp did have the affidavit?
The government.
I don't believe that there is any evidence that Ms. Fripp did have the affidavit. And in fact, she did testify at trial that she doesn't recall the interview, but had she had that information, she would not have allowed him to naturalize. So she did testify to that. But it's Mr. Arango's position that there is some constructive knowledge of that affidavit. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you for the argument this morning. United States v. Arango is submitted.